and Bob, I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
Sober through the grace of God in AA since the 10th of December, 1967. For that, I'm very grateful. It's good to be here. Richard, that's when you put a conference together like you have done, it is a gift that keeps giving. You know, there's lots of service things we do, but this keeps adding. You know, for a long, long time, this will become a tradition, and there will be people whose lives will be changed or affected or encouraged. I always got a kick. Dick was talking about how old we are. I think we ought to get the age reduced a little bit. We need to bring some fresh blood in. An average of 45 years is getting dangerously close to the ball going well over the hill. And my mother used to say, Bob, you're not very bright. Dress well. So I didn't start in a lofty place. And it's nice to be here with my wife, Linda. Would you stand up, Linda? And so I'm going to talk a little bit. I didn't know I was going to do this. I was going to do it in drag so that you couldn't tell. But I couldn't find shoes, so I left the outfit in the room, and I'm going to do this. It is interesting, though, at these Woodstocks attract a little different crowd, and they do a little different thing, I think. For a long time, I mean, if you've been in AA 30 or 40 years, you've heard some of the great service people talk a lot. And when they come here and don't give their talk, you hear something different. It's just like they change cadence, and I do think we catch something from each other. That is pretty cool. Born and raised in St. Paul, Minnesota, one of seven kids. Born and raised in a Catholic ghetto. If you had less than seven children, you had a reproduction problem. We had clans. I mean, we had families, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. You know, we're just, and the kids kind of stair-stepped through the, and we all played sports against each other, and we went to the parochial schools, and that was my background. Our parents were the Second World War crew. They worked hard, played hard, started big companies, and had big families, and were active in the community, and they drank a lot. Cocktail parties were the order of the day, and we copied our parents. And we stole their booze and imitated them. In high school, I went to a military high school and a college campus. We drank in high school like most people drink in college. We had fraternities. Of my six closest friends in high school, three of which I've been friends with since I've been 6 years old, five are members of Alcoholics Anonymous. One's an Al-Anon. That would be my college roommate. And my next-door neighbor has brain damage due to alcoholism, and I heard recently that he is sober and he's okay. But we did a lot of drinking. And, I mean, those are kind of unusual numbers. We only had 120 people in my high school class to have. We have 11 or 12 members of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's a lot of alcoholism. That's a lot of recovery. And you know, I was 4'11" when I entered high school. Mom sent the oldest kids to school early, and I was, felt like everybody else had a meeting, started the day. I kept missing the meeting. Everybody else knew what to do. I didn't know what to do. One day I took a drink, and I felt like you looked, and I felt all of a sudden I was able to mingle, mix. Part of what we're doing here in this room is we're kind of gathering around the bonfire, you know, bringing our damp logs back to the bonfire of AA, and we're telling the story of Christmas, which is this time of year as we come. It's the same story. It's the same thing. It's like we're like little kids. Tell me again, Daddy, what happened? What did you do? And if you miss a word, you know, they've got to go back and stop you and get you to put the word in, because it is our story, and the mind doesn't hold it. It's a spiritual story. It's a spiritual experience. So, you know, we keep forgetting. I remember a few years ago I was in the midst of another financial debacle, and I was having a really tough time. And I tend to be a little depressed anyway. And I went to this psychologist, who's, I don't know, I forget what school of psychology she is, but she's like Earth Mother. I mean, she is, you know, she's an old broad, and she's just wonderful. And I come in there, and I'm in tears, and I'm about to tell her my tale of woe, and she looked at me, and she said, "Oh, baby, you just forgot who you are." And that's, I think, a little bit about what happens in these rooms, as we keep reminding ourselves, both the speaker and the listener, as to who we are. I took my first drink of alcohol. My life changed. I took to it, and I drank as much and as fast as I could in high school. I was the guy making the false IDs. I got a couple of arrests, car accident. My drinking was the largest subject of negative conversation in our home. I thought my problem drinking was because I was underage. The cops didn't like it. My parents didn't like it. And I could not get why all the grown-ups could drink and why the, you know, I kind of got it. But went away to school, thought my drinking had become normal, get away from my father, get away from the police, and that didn't happen. I drank my way out of the University of Notre Dame in the middle of my senior year. I was in the yearbook with my class ring and walked out of school. And that is the story of my life, and is the story of many of ours. We interview well, we just don't perform very well. And, remember when I went back to make amends to the boss that hired me just before I got sober, and he said, "God, you interviewed so well." I said, yeah, we do. Yeah. And I could not stop drinking. I was the, I'm an ROTC. I'm getting $90 a month from them, and I'm a card player, and I'm a pool player, and I just, I start as a B student in civil engineering and end up as a 2.000 guy riding the cliff. I had three guys petition to have me removed from engineering school. I mean, I was literally, you got to drink pretty good to be the class drunk at Notre Dame. I was the class drunk at Notre Dame. They used my room as a study hall. And one day I had it. I went in and I quit. I had to give up my commission. I got a medical release for alcoholism. I was diagnosed an alcoholic when I was 19. That seemed nuts to me. I can't tell you how nuts that, we're kidding about cross-dressing. I remember I was going to a psychiatrist that diagnosed me as an alcoholic. Interesting guy. Later, he would have me work with, bring some of his patients to AA, not work with them. And he kept trying to convince me I had a drinking problem. I said I drink like everybody else. He was trying to convince me that I didn't drink. I drink. I just picked different people and did it more often and had different consequences. And but just before I went back to my senior year, I was robbed, rolled, pistol whipped, shot at, thrown out of the second story of a hotel. I was ended up in the psych ward of a hospital, and they were not going to let me go back to school. I talked my way out of that. I went back to school. And I went to the library, and I got a book on alcoholism, and it turned out to be a Freudian-based book that related alcoholism to latent homosexuality. The combination of the two was just kind of toxic. I could not get myself to. And then he sent me to a woman psychiatrist, and the first question she asked me if I was gay. And the combination of all those things, I might have been able to get myself to go to an AA meeting, but after those three things happened, I was not able to do that. And I came home, and I look back on that. I can remember my friend saying, "God, we're going to go up to the Kentucky Derby. And, $100, go to Kentucky Derby." And what do? I go buy 4/5, and I go get an overstuffed chair, and I pull it up in my room, and I get War and Peace, and I drink. I read War and Peace and drink 4/5 in 3 or 4 days. Well, because that's what I probably would have done if I went to the Derby. And that was my drinking was that established at that point, and I couldn't shut it down. Got alcohol poisoning when I was down there in summer school. When I walked out, I came home, I finished school at a local university. My father asked me to leave the house. He said, "We love you, we just literally do not know what to do with you." And took a job at a liquor store. And it's important to use your gifts. Linda and I have three boys. Men, I guess, 40, 45, does that qualify as a... They're pretty immature. I don't, 45, 42, and 30, 33. And they are sober 25, 22, and 15 or 16. I know their names. I just don't. I just have trouble with the rest. And you get to ride the other side of that pony. You get to see. You know, I got to live. I got the karmic experience of living through our three sons, living their lives the way alcoholics and drug addicted people live their lives. And suffering as the watcher of that and the person who felt responsible for it, and being disappointed that my wife is a carrier. You know, those three things. None of us were alcoholic when we met her. I rest my case. Okay, I worked at the liquor store for 6 months. I'm stealing booze out of the liquor store. I'm drinking as much as I can drink. I don't know. Every other day I'm drinking a fifth a day. I get fired for a variety of reasons. I take a job as a waiter. I'm living not on Skid Row, but next door. I'm shacked up with waiters and waitresses. No one knows where I am, which is what I want. I don't want anybody to know where I am. I'm ashamed of where I am. I'm waiting to see what, you know, the service is going to do with me. Vietnam's on. The draft is on. I know I'm going to have to go in, and I don't know what the hell to do. And I wake up at 6 in the morning, drink a couple of beers. I go to work at, you know, or not 6 in the morning, 8 in the morning. I go to work at 10. From 10 to 2, I work as a waiter. From 2 to 5, I go drink in a bar. And at 5, I go buy a pint. And I work until we close the place down. And then I go find the place I'm supposed to live. Towards the end of that, I get into a fight. I get my face kicked in. I get fired as a waiter. I got no place to go. I go back to my family, and I ask if I can move back in the house. And they allow me to move back in the house. They ask me not to drink. I promise I won't drink. I can't not drink. I stop, but I fall apart. I go starting to go through withdrawal. When I moved back in the house, I really tried to change my life. I was as tired of being the family jerk as they were having me be the family jerk. I got back together with Linda, which was a pretty good move. Next Monday, I will celebrate 46 years of sobriety. Last Monday was our 46th wedding anniversary. The week before that was my 70th birthday, so they were all kind of crammed in one. I got back together with Linda. We'd gone for, I don't know, we can't remember anymore. We went together for a year and a half, broke up for about a year, and then came together. She was a psychiatric nurse working in an alcohol ward. When I asked her to, you know, I had just gotten my face kicked in. And I show up at a party somewhat incoherent, asking if I could get together with her the next day. And when we got together, I asked her if she would get back together with me with the idea that we might get married, and she said yes. So while she's attractive, she's one sandwich short of a picnic. I mean, that is, you know. I bought a car, I got a job as the service lost my file. So I was about ready to go to OCS school. They lost my file. They asked me to take the physical again. They failed me. Fourth time I took the physical, so I didn't have to go. I go get a job at a manufacturing company in the engineering department, and now I'm the company drunk. I mean, I don't know that I'm in this much trouble. I mean, in school, I could cover up, dress well. My mother said, you know, try to look good. I was fairly smart, fairly good at science, so I could, you know, I kind of faked it, you know, along the way. When you start to get out in the world, I mean, they put me behind a desk. I had no idea. I kept looking for the steering wheel. I had no idea what to do behind a desk. I mean, I didn't know that no one knew what to do behind a desk. You weren't trained to do that. But, I mean, I used up my sick leave in the first 3 months. I'm falling asleep at my desk. I cannot stop drinking. I don't, you know. A couple of months ago, we went to a bar that I used to do a lot of drinking at on the way home, and, you know, brought back a lot of memories. I'd just go in there to get a couple after work, or I'd go in there at noon, and, you know, I've got that alcoholic thing going on, and I can't not, you know, I can't not drink. I quit that job. I take a job as a salesman. I'm in that job about a month, and a buddy of ours gets married, and I go out on a four-day run. I wake up Thursday, August 1967, and that was my moment. I'm hugging the toilet in a pair of boxer shirts, and all of a sudden I just thought, how the hell did you get here? And I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And two guys came out, you know, old-timer down central office, called two guys, met me at a broiler cafe about a mile away from our home. One guy had 6 months, one guy had 6 years. When you're young and in trouble, families try everything they know to figure out what the hell's wrong with you. I had been to doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs, bishop, priests, nuns, psychologists, psychiatrists, proctologists. I had run. But I had never talked to a person who was a drinker. And these two men, one was a potter, and one made orthopedic braces. And they sat me down and they told me their story. They said, we had a drinking problem. We found an answer for it. Want to share it with you. If it helps you, that's great. If it doesn't, don't worry about it. For some reason, it helps us talking to guys like you. And they told me their story. And I found myself, in an hour and a half, I found myself sharing stuff with them that I'd never shared with anybody. And everybody else wants to know why. You know, why'd you park the car in the living room? You know, these guys, you know, they don't... We don't ask each other why. Because we have all done the unexplainable things. I mean, there is no explanation. If you're one of us, you don't have to explain. You just know. And I went to my first meeting. I drank twice after that, once on a business trip to the West Coast. I can't believe I was in Santa Monica by Clancy's meeting. And you're not too far from Clancy's meeting. And I didn't go to AA like they told me to do. And I drank. I got in trouble. I came home. Had around 3 months of sobriety, and then Linda and I were married, and I drank on our honeymoon. And, you know, where the divers dive off those cliffs in Mexico, I dove off those cliffs on my last drunk. And I really easily could have killed myself. If I would have jumped, which is what I was thinking of doing, I would have died. You know, but for some reason, I decided to dive, and I got out far enough that I said, later, Linda and I, we used to go down there with the kids, and I said, that's the dumbest thing I've ever done. She said, it's not even in the top 10. So, it is. But, so all of us have this, I don't know. I show up my first AA meeting, I'm 23 years old. I don't have a clue. I'm there because I've tried what I know how to try. It seems like someone 23 should not be an alcoholic. I mean, I could tell you story after story of a drinking story. I didn't feel like an alcoholic. I mean, I knew I drank differently. I can remember, you know, I lied about my drinking to anybody of authority. But as time went on, I lied to my friends. I didn't want anybody to know what I was, except for maybe Downey. You know, I had a couple of guys that we dropped the girls off. Girls had to be back at the dorm at a certain time, and we'd drop the girls off, and then we'd go drink. And we'd drink with the girls, but we would go on. And I had a wall built around me, and, you know, people would come to me and they'd say, Bob, I think you're an alcoholic. And I'd say, well, I think I can see with what you know about me why you think I'm an alcoholic, but there's a lot of things about me you don't know. And I think if you knew about, I'm not saying this to you, but I think if you knew about those things, you wouldn't think I was just an alcoholic. Just before I went back to my senior year, I quit for 2 months when I went down there. My life didn't instantaneously get better. I didn't all of a sudden become what you were telling me I'd become if I just wouldn't drink. I didn't become an A student, a model kid. It was really a pretty crappy time. And I thought I proved two things to myself. One is I could quit. And two is quitting didn't work. And I don't know what the hell's wrong with me, but it's scary. It's like I have a built-in failure mechanism. I start out okay, but I don't finish anything. And I don't know what the hell's wrong with me. I look at my friends. Of the 12 guys in my high school that went down to Notre Dame, I had the highest test grades going down. I was the only one who didn't finish. And that's my story. I don't finish. And so I had that wall built around me that said, you like me, but you only like what it lets you see about me. If you could see everything about me, you'd hate me. Hell, I hate me. Who knows more what a lousy, crummy, insufficient person I am than me? I'm walking around comparing my inside with your outside. The only way you come out doing that is second best. And I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was given the gift of surrender. And I tore the wall down, and I made a discovery. And the discovery was that I'm not unique. My personality may be unique, but not my illness, not my behavior, not my feelings, and not my experience. And I started to have a sense of hope that what worked for you could work for me. At my first meeting of AA, I met my sponsor, Warren McGinley. He died 2.5 years ago. And he was the 12-step champion of the Uptown group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Second World War guy, lost half his crew in Italy, bomb disposal unit. He was a mailman. He was an ordinary guy. He was a profoundly ordinary guy. I mean, they give awards to people who save four or five people's lives. That man and his 12-step work, I think a couple of hundred. I mean, he just was, you know, he just made 12-step calls and took people to Alcoholics Anonymous. He wasn't very fancy, but he was our copy of the big book. His wife was Linda's sponsor for until she died. Warren sat me down in a chair and he said, "Bob, alcoholism is a disease." I did not know that. I don't know what the hell I thought it was, but he said it's physical, emotional, and spiritual. He said once you cross the line from problem drinking into alcoholism, your alcoholism affects you all the time when you're drinking and when you're not drinking. The idea that my alcoholism could affect me when I was not drinking was a very new, sophisticated idea. No one, with all the help I had, I was either never told that or did not understand it if I was told it. He said, what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous, once we take our last drink or drug, we use the 12 steps to change to find a different way to live that's better than the way we lived before, so we don't have to go back to drugs or booze to do something for us that we're unwilling or unable to do for ourselves. If you don't change, you will not stay. Gettysburg Address of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started my journey with that guy. Had my last drink on the airplane on the way home from our December the 10th, 1967. And I thought it would be hard for me to explain how welcoming AA seemed to me when I walked in that room. I'm a 23-year-old punk in a room full of mostly Second World War vets. No one told me that come back when I'm older. No one told me that I, you know, didn't belong in that room. There were one or two younger people, but the majority of the people in that room were 50 years old and older. And to hear those men, two women, Rose and Helen, to hear those 30 men talk about the same problems that I had, to talk about fear, to talk about work, to talk about not being able to do what they wanted to do, not be able to perform, not be able to take care of their responsibilities, in the simple, profound way, I just felt like I was home. My gift is I've loved AA since the moment I walked in the front door. It's been hard for me to do the work, but it's been easy for me to stay. And that's my gift. I worked with a hell of a lot of young people in those days, and not many people stuck. And they were smarter, they needed it more, they had it worse, and they wouldn't stay because they didn't identify. And my gift was I identified. And I thought, okay, I identify. And if I got the problem and you got the answer, I got about a half a dozen other problems that are going on in my life. And if you've got the answer, hell, those ought to go away and help. Might take a year. Might take 50. Might take 55. How are you doing, Clance? I mean, they just don't disappear. You know, you don't get to wipe out all the devils that we are trying to deal with in our lives. And in Minnesota, 99% of the meetings are closed-step discussion groups. We get into a room, there's 30 guys in a room, someone gives a step, we break up into two, and then we discuss the step, and we go home. So we've got a lot of, I mean, our whole orientation, today there are more big book meetings and discussion meetings and speaker meetings, but there were almost none when I came in. And I started to work the steps. I was pathologically immature. I was somewhat sophisticated. I looked okay. I could not work. I mean, if you want to know what was wrong with me, the core issue, I mean, I had trouble getting to work, I had trouble staying at work, and I had trouble working at work. Other than that, I was a good worker. But, I mean, think of that. I mean, I'm getting married. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons that, you know, drove me into AA is I'm getting married in my family. You don't take care of your wife. You better move towns, baby, because they're going to have a blanket party, and it is not going to work. And I got a gambling problem. 4 or 5 hours a day, 4 or 5 days a week. I'm a backgammon player. I'm making $5,000 a year playing back. Now, my salary was $6,000 a year. It's 1967, guys. And I'm making $5,000 a year playing backgammon, and it's like a second job. So I've always been a gambler. It's kind of always where I made my pocket change, and it's always where I made my drinking money. And we start to have kids. I am loud, impatient, angry, immature, and sometimes violent with my children. That's a shameful thing to say. And today I have a good relationship with those boys, but I'll tell you, it's a lot of shame in how I behaved during some of them. And that's two or three generations old in my family. I mean, I grew up in a time where, you know, you didn't come home and tell your old man that you got in trouble at school because you'd get it twice. The teachers would hit you. You screw up at a neighbor's house, your neighbor would hit you. I mean, this was all a community. You did not, I mean, this was not, I mean, we had coaches that would pick you up by the neck, you know, out of a chair. I mean, it was not, and it wasn't, it was a great school. It was, I mean, it really was. It's kind of a Catholic thing. We really like suffering, and it's we offer it up. And, so I'm gambling. I can't stop gambling. I'm good at it, and I can't stop it. I'm having trouble with the kids. I'm having trouble with Linda, and I'm spending $200 or $300 more a month than I made, and I'm going backwards every step I take. And I'm busting my britches. So I did my first fourth and fifth step when I was sober about 3 months. I didn't get into the causes and conditions at all. I just got into the things that bothered me the most that I had done. It was kind of a guilt cleansing sort of thing. The second one, I don't even remember how well I did or did not do on my second fifth step, but I'm going to talk about my third. So I found myself in AA with the same damn problems I had when I walked in the front door of Alcoholics Anonymous. I paid my bills off in the first year of our sobriety, and then all of a sudden I'm going backwards, and I've got 6 years of sobriety. I got the bills again. I still don't know how to work. I'm gambling. I try to quit, and I can't do it, and I'm having trouble with my anger. And I'm busting my britches to try to change those things, and I can't change them. I'm on the down escalator going up. And this is just kind of how life felt to me. You know, this is just, you're here again. You know, you started okay, but you ended up, you know, not doing very well. And I'm doing all, I've got all the AA merit badges. I'm sponsoring people. I'm giving talks. I'm active in service. I'm my sponsor's wingman. I'm doing AA pretty well. Well, AA is a hell of a lot easier to do than life, in my experience. And it's the combination of the two that brings us to the work that we're supposed to do. It is the mistakes and shortcomings as we live our lives in marriage, in parenting, in work, in being a child of, you know, it's the mistakes we make in that process that bring us in front of the steps in a not a theoretical way, in a real way. So when we're doing the steps kind of in the absence of life, they're pretty easy to understand and easier to undertake and do, almost at a mental or philosophical or psychological level. But if you're married with children and you've got a job, I mean, you've got a lot of rich, you know, subjects to deal with as we go through life. I don't know anybody here is knocking it out of the park. And that is what, you know, so I'm having some trouble. And I know what the answer is. The answer is to find out what God has to do with Wednesday. The thing that has saved my bacon in AA, old timers. The people I was attracted to, another gift. I don't know, why was a 23, 24, 30-year-old kid attracted to the 60-year-olds that have 20-some years of sobriety? I can't tell you. But those were my folks. I would, you know, meetings at 8 o'clock, I'd come home at 11, 11:30. I just never wanted the thing to stop. I'm, you know, most surprisingly, a lot of those old-timers went to one meeting a week. They did a lot of 12-step work, but they didn't go to the number of meetings that we go to. I'm going to 6 or 7 meetings a week. And finally, at 7 years of sobriety, I am toast. I am just done. I run into, and both Linda and I at about that time had a kind of a second surrender. I just, you know, I'd be sitting in the club and a new guy'd come in and I'd give him a cup of coffee and sit him down. He'd share that bushel basket full of manure that he had. He'd tell me about the wife and the IRS and the cops and the job and I'd say, hey, you're in the right spot. Get a cup of coffee, sit down. You stay here. You get a sponsor, you get into the book, and you don't have to do it perfectly, but just do it seriously. You're going to be okay. Then I'd get in the car, and I'd drive home, and I'd say, Bob, when are you going to be okay? You got 7 years of sobriety, and you don't know how to work. Everybody knows how to work, jerk. You don't know how to work. When are you going to quit gambling? When are you going to be more gentle with your children? I didn't have an answer. I'm not thinking about drinking, but I'm thinking about sticking a gun in my mouth. I'm tired of being there again. And I could go to God, but, you know, you don't have to be a genius to figure out what God's going to ask me to do. Get up in the morning. Go to work. Stay at work. Work at work. Quit gambling. Be kind and loving to your wife. Get on a budget, which I think is an Al-Anon word. It's not in the book. It's kind of a harsh word. And I'm going to say, hell, if I knew how to do all those things, I wouldn't need God. You know, I mean, what the hell do you think I've been trying to do for the last 6 or 7 years? And what the hell is the use of developing a relationship with a higher power if you can't fulfill the conditions of the relationship? I mean, I think I know what God wants me to do. And is that for me? Those guys from Louisiana, you just can't. So I know what God. I think I know what God wants me to do, and I've been trying to do it. And as soon as I do some of it, as soon as I get my act cleaned up a little bit, where I could, you know, feel like I could start to have that relationship, I'll do it. But I never got there. And out of desperation, I went back to the steps for the third time. And I took a look at powerlessness and unmanageability. That was the easiest. That was a no-brainer. I mean, I was out of control. Life was unmanageable. The thing that shocked me is I had lost step two. I believed it for us, but not for me. I believed it for the newcomer, but I'm busting my britches going to 6-7 meetings a week, and I'm going backwards. And that feels pretty goddamn familiar, and I don't like it, and I don't know what to do about it. And I think when you're in trouble, you either get more or less active. And I started to look around, and I saw people with bigger problems than I had, with smiles on their faces, walking through walls that I was trying to avoid with dignity. And I came to believe that God would restore me to sanity. I took step three on my knees with my sponsor in his office. We didn't do that in those days, but I started to hear some of those California people talk about that, and I thought, maybe I'd try that. And it's a little awkward, but I didn't die, and I didn't. And then I did my third, fourth step, and I did my previous two fifth steps I'd done with clergy. I did my fifth step with my sponsor. And I said, be careful, because when you're done, I'm going to do whatever you recommend. I said, I feel like I'm dying of thirst laying next to a lake. I said, I know what to do. I just don't do it. You could give me a test. I could tell you could come to my house with the bushel basket full of crap of the problems that I have, and I could tell you what to do. I just can't or won't do it. And I did my fifth step. One of the things he wanted me to do, he said, you got a lot of issues around money, work, failure, and success. My dad was a pretty successful guy. He said, I want you to find a psychologist that works with business people. And I want you to go have some of the conversations with him, and then I want you to bring the conversations back to me. We can put them in the context of the program. And I got a psychologist. He wanted to get Linda involved. I did not want Linda involved. When your wife's involved, it's a whole different data bank. There's a whole different level of information available in the conversation than if you're the only one in the room. And I didn't think that was necessary, but what the hell. And then he wanted the kids involved, and I was ashamed of that. I don't know why. I still, to this day, don't know why the hell he had the kids involved. He was a good psychologist. And I remember I'm telling him that my business is failing, and I'm going to go broke, and I'm busting my ass 2 or 3 hours a day. And and I'm explaining that, you know, everything I have is going to go away. And he looked at me and he said, why are you so afraid of failure? And I wanted to hit him. My reaction was, and I was surprised by that, nice man. You know, and I said, look, I've been born and raised in this town. I lived here all my life. I'm in the investment business. I'm about, you know, my company's going to go down. I'm going to file bankruptcy and put my name in the paper. I'm going to lose everything I have. I said, nod your head up and down if you understand that. I said, you're a doctor. You go broke, you just take your little sign, walk down the hall, pound it on another door, and in 6 months, you're making $100,000 again. I said, I'm going to lose everything. He looked at Linda and he said, if Bob lost everything, would he lose you? And Linda said, no, you wouldn't lose me. And he asked Billy and Peter the question. And the kids said, no, if you can't lose, you can't play. And what I discovered with the psychologist was fear. Now, you'd think a guy who had done three inventories would know more about fear than I knew. My fear had to do with dogs, snakes, and tall buildings. And what I discovered is I'm afraid of being a husband. I'm afraid of being a father. I'm afraid of work. I'm afraid of failure. I'm afraid of success. I mean, you know, that old Chamberlain thing about the three fishes in the ocean, and one fish looks over at the other and says, isn't the ocean wonderful? And the other guy looks over and says, what's the ocean? I'm swimming in fear and do not know. Okay. And not too long after that, I had a second surrender. And I realized that I had tried everything I knew how to try, and I had failed at ridding myself of my defects of character. And all of a sudden I had this thought, is why don't you start right where you're at? And I got down on my knees and took the sixth and the seventh step of the program of AA at a level that I had not taken them before. Sixth step said they were entirely ready to have God remove defects of character. The seventh step said we humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. I had spent the first 7 years or 8 years of my AA trying to get rid of them. I don't have the power. I have the responsibility. It is my job, but it happens through me, not by me. I am the pipe, not the well. The doctor doesn't heal. He creates an aseptic environment. He creates an atmosphere in which healing can take place and God heal. Today, there's so much teaching about the 12 steps in Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the things that sometimes come, and some of the teaching that all of us get into when we talk about it, it's of mind. And it's the mind talking about a spiritual process. And it's like bringing a knife to a gunfight. Words cannot totally encapsulate what happens in the steps because it's a spiritual process and it's of God. And I think there's a tendency when we talk about it, when we teach, especially at these Woodstocks, you know, I want to get the quote that you have with Dr. Bob. I mean, he's saying they're very simple. You don't have to have a master's degree to do a four-step, but we're talking an hour and a half on each step. Well, I mean, you've got to throw some complication into a simple process to talk an hour and a half on the step. I mean, it is, and I think in some ways we do a disservice to ourselves. And I like this format and these conferences better than any other conferences that I go to. So I'm not sitting here talking out of both sides of my mouth. I'm just saying that I think we do complicate it. That's the nature of it. And I think the issue that many of us have sitting in the room that are 15, 27, 30, 40 years sober with trouble is we're in a spiritual process using psychology and intellect. When the real answer comes from cooperating with a power greater than ourselves. Our problem for most of us with the entrenching problem, are there any new problems in the room? Are there any problems in the room that are less than 5 years old, other than, you know, just recent financial problems? I mean, our problems aren't days old. They aren't months old. They're years old. But mostly, I can't get myself to present myself with an abandon to have those habits and patterns released. And I don't think we realize how much they are taken away as opposed to me getting a new idea and working at it effectively and me getting rid of it. Page 84 and 85, my favorite part of the book, favorite couple of paragraphs in the book, comes after the promises of after step 9, but it's the promises after step 10 on 84 and 85 that are just as powerful, and it talks about the problem has been removed. It doesn't exist for us. You know, we're not fighting it. You know, I mean, it really talks about the fact that it happens. I think that it happens through us. That night when I got down on my knees and took the sixth and the seventh step, four of the major problems of my life disappeared that night. I quit gambling that night. Okay. I turned my checkbook over to my wife, who does not have the issues with money. My wife happens to be a good money manager. Not all spouses are, but my blessing is she is. And she had us out of trouble in about a year. She could pay half a bill. I mean, I thought, how can you pay half a bill? I mean, they're going to think you don't have the money. You know, I mean, I could never get that. You know, she put me on an allowance. You know, she's, I still kind of feel like I'm kept. She puts $100 on the dresser every week. And I started dating Linda. I took her out every Friday night for 35 years or so. We've kind of stopped that. And one of her great complaints was I was too active in AA. And one of the things that happened out of that is all of a sudden the guy that didn't know how to work learned how to work, and I became lucky and successful. And she was able to quit work over a period of the next 4 or 5 years and get a housekeeper. And all of a sudden there was enough juice in the middle of that that we were able to, I was able to stay about as active as I've ever been in Alcoholics Anonymous. But between our date night and the vacations that we were able to take, we had a balance that we did not have before, and it was able to work. My life changed that night more than when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I stood naked in front of my alcoholism, and I looked in the mirror, and I saw the truth of my alcoholism. That night, I saw the truth of my life. And I don't know if I've ever been. And what happens to you when you have that moment? You become, your ego collapses and you become more teachable. You become more open. I called my sponsor. I made a deal with my sponsor about when I'd go to work and how long I'd stay at work. I remember making it. I never made sales calls. I just lied about what I did. I never even took the chance that you'd drag me across the desk and force me to sell you something. And I had to go sell some real estate investments early in the formation of a company that my partner is 50 years sober, or will be in January. And I can remember being out in the parking lot of General Mills, going up to call on an executive to make a $10,000 investment, knowing it would not work. I'm scared to death. I do not want to make the call. And I'm reading the big book, and I figured, screw it. You know, the only thing I ever did regularly was AA work. I did it when I was supposed to do it, I did what I was supposed to do, and all what I started to do is make work an AA work. So I got out of the car, got in the elevator, went up to the guy, and the guy bought 10 grand worth. And I made $1,000. And I'm on the elevator on the way down, and I'm thinking, you know, if a guy did that regularly, I never made less in a month from that moment on than I made in the previous year for the rest up until this day. So I made enough money to burn a wet elephant over the next 10 years. And then they passed the Tax Act, and I went broke. And I'll tell you, it is, that was not fun. That was not like changing my clothes. It was tearing the skin off my body. If any of you are out there praying to be a millionaire, include the idea of keeping it. as long as you're asking, you might as well. I mean, it never occurs to us that if we ever got it, that we'd lose it. I just want to report to you that there are some experiences on the other side of the fence that you might want to include the idea of keeping it. And that was about the same time our kids were coming in to AA and things were pretty tough. And I was sober about 20 or 25 years in those days, and I just, you know, I was depressed, I was scared, I thought my life was over. I don't know, if there's no greater place in Alcoholics Anonymous. And recently I had another significant financial downturn after 2008. Old and dumb is a really horrible combination. If you're looking for a combination, pick one of the two, but don't pick both. And I lost about half our net worth through, you know, some really horseshit decisions and ill management. And, you know, but there's no greater place to bring your broken toys. I mean, we are a place, as Bill Wilson talked about, we're problem people. I mean, it is just, you know, you're ashamed to have the conversation to say I did it again, but we are people who did it again. And the good news is we have a way out. We have a set of steps that the circumstances do not have to grind you down. That is the miracle. You know, I thought if, you know, I'd come into Alcoholics Anonymous and you'd teach me how to do the steps, and I would do the steps in such a way that my life would be problem-free. As a young guy, most of the people I looked at in those AA meetings, their lives seemed problem-free. No, it was just stupid. But I admired them. You don't kind of see the problems of people you admire. And today I look at it, and there isn't anybody who has a problem-free life. But there are all sorts of people who do not get taken down with the problems they have. The courage, I mean, the thing that is, you know, we come to AA because our lives are in trouble. We come to AA because we've got a drinking problem or a using problem. And we come in here, they take us through the steps, and if we go through the steps with any kind of seriousness, we find sobriety. But what happens to us if we stay? Now, realize that when we come into Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're drinking a pint to a fifth a day, there's something wrong with your head. I mean, normal people don't need to do that. I mean, in order to feel okay or to feel better, if that's how you're medicating yourself, and when you stop that medication, the problem doesn't go away. The problem presents itself. So we've got a set of steps that get you to surrender, which is the greatest gift. You want to know our gift? Our gift isn't recovery. Our gift is surrender. We never would have recovered without being broken down. You know, I mean, this is the classic of the Odyssey. This is Paul renting a donkey and going to Damascus. This is the, you know, the son, the bad son, prodigal son. You know, I mean, this is the story that you can't get the message until you've been broken down. And so the gift is being broken down. I mean, and being broken down and then being presented with the answer. And that's what those of us that are in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous have been able to do. We've been able to put together lives that are better than if we had never had the disease. If you stayed here and you get into the... So we have an internal conversation when you come here that's killing us. It's killing us. And somehow you have to find a power greater than yourself. Because if you don't find a power greater than yourself, you're your own power. If you're your own power, that's the conversation you brought in the front door is the conversation that's going to take you out the back door. It's the conversation that's going to put a gun in your mouth. You've got to find another conversation. And Alcoholics Anonymous has that conversation. It's a conversation of God. It's a conversation of recovery. It's a conversation of steps. The book, sponsorship, calling on people. And all of a sudden, little by little, without even intending it, some of the hard asses today talk about, you know, that, you know, they kind of belittle going to meet, you know, meeting-based sobriety isn't, you know, it's not good. You have to have book, and you have to, you know, learn the books really, really, really well. And there's nothing, that's fine. Read the book and learn it really, really, really well. But what happens in the rooms is you check, for some reason, you kind of check your mind at the door. And you bring your damp log into the bonfire of Alcoholics Anonymous, and little by little it dries out. And little by little, all of a sudden, it bursts into someone lights your pilot light. Once your pilot light is lit, you're okay. This is a personal program. I mean, we have different IQs, different backgrounds, different schooling, different interests, different levels of spirituality. We don't do it the same. We take the same steps, but the experience is not identical. It is similar. It is the experience of a traveler. But it's almost as if we're traveling in different countries and we're having the experience of a spiritual traveler. And I don't know why I was so lucky to end up with the problems that I had as early as I have been and being able to be exposed to the solution as early as I was exposed to it. But today, as I stand here as an old guy, and I take a look at the last 46 years, I take a look at the fact that I have a life today that's good. You know, I'm not hurting anybody today. I've stopped digging the hole. And I never would have been able to do that without you. And all of it is because I was able to find a power greater than myself. And the only reason I was able to find that power greater than myself is I broke down. And when I broke down, I found you. Thank you.